This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for the week ending 3 June 2016 for Expressions of Peace, Personal, Powerful, and Heart-to-Heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace radio tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With global extreme weather as the organizing principle, Sequitur covers habitat destruction, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as a result of human activity. Sequitur moves from our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels to a place of acceptance of the natural consequences of those actions. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zympht, that's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. More of his work is linked at panina.org, or you can find him on SoundCloud. Sequitur was already in production last week when the news broke about Australia's removal of the Great Barrier Reef chapter and purging of all other mentions of the land down under from the UNESCO World Heritage Report co-authored by the United Nations Environment Programme and the Union of Concerned Scientists. But the Australia Guardian and the Union of Concerned Scientists published the controversial chapter anyway. Together with the defunding of climate science at CSIRO, it is clear where Malcolm Turnbull is positioning his party as he faces upcoming federal elections. He is courting the coal industry, who want increased processing and shipping in the region regardless of environmental consequences. Following is a small sample of the ensuing media coverage. First, obediently, with no mention of commerce, tourism, Australia in general, or the Great Barrier Reef in particular, Sky News reports, quote, "Scientists and UN experts say extreme weather is becoming one of the biggest risks to World Heritage icons," unquote. From the Washington Post, "There are roughly 1,000 World Heritage locations worldwide. The UNESCO report focuses on 31 sites in 29 countries and names both climate change and tourism as threats." From the New York Times, Will Steffen, professor at the Climate Change Institute at Australian National University, is troubled that a government department has succeeded in censoring a global report. Quote, "Australia is the only inhabited continent that is not featured in the report. Information is the currency of democracy, and the idea that government officials would exert pressure to censor scientific information on our greatest national treasure is extremely disturbing." Close quote. From Fortune, the report says that the sites are vulnerable to the effects of climate change. Australia's Great Barrier Reef and the Tasmanian forests were also included in the report before Australia's government intervened, telling the UN that it could damage tourism on the continent, reported The Guardian. Close quote. From The Guardian, quote, "The Great Barrier Reef is in the midst of the worst crisis in recorded history. Unusually warm water has caused 93% of the reefs along the 2,300-kilometer site to experience bleaching. In the northernmost pristine part, scientists think half the coral might have died." Unquote. From CNN, in contrast to the official response in Australia, in Thailand, more than 10 National Marine Park diving sites have closed, with more closures projected amid the country's continued efforts to seal off its famous tourist attractions to protect the environment. At its worst in over 6 years, coral bleaching has spread widely between 40% to 80% of the reefs along both the Gulf of Thailand to the east and the Andaman Sea to the west, according to Natapol Ratanaphin, director of the Marine National Park Division. High tourist numbers produce problems such as litter and food waste, as well as gasoline from tour boats leaching into waters. Bleaching occurs when water temperatures stay above 30.5 C for 2 to 3 weeks. Temperatures were as high as 34 C in early April through early May. From news.com, the Labour Party has pledged $500 million for a three-tiered rescue effort: a funding boost for CSIRO's reef-specific climate research, direct investment to improve water quality and land management, and reef management and conservation coordination. A summary of the report was posted by the Homeland Security News Wire. The report says the sites are already being impacted by climate change and are vulnerable to increasing temperatures, melting glaciers, rising seas, intensifying weather events, worsening droughts, and longer wildfire seasons. It does not say that the sites are already being impacted and are vulnerable to increasing impact from tourism. The report calls urgently on authorities to identify the World Heritage sites that are most vulnerable to climate change and provide policies and resources to increase resilience at those sites, ensure that the threat of climate impacts is taken into account in the nomination and listing process for new World Heritage sites, engage the tourism sector in efforts to manage and protect vulnerable sites in the face of climate change and educate visitors about climate threats, increase global efforts to meet the Paris Agreement climate change pledges in order to preserve World Heritage sites for future generations. It's been a big week for conferences. Reuters predicts that the increase in diplomatic interest in climate change that was demonstrated at the two-week United Nations Climate Change Conference in Bonn, Germany, bodes well for global mitigation efforts since diplomats tend to have more policy clout than do climate scientists. Patricia Espinoza, a former Mexican foreign minister, will take over from Cristiana Figueres of Costa Rica as UN climate chief. The Bonn conference put on a public face of positive good cheer, but the story behind closed doors was one of animosity between the underdeveloped nations who had very little to do with our present predicament and the overdeveloped nations who are being asked to finance global mitigation measures, reports Climate Change News. It is estimated that the least developed countries need $3 trillion to deliver on the promises they made at the Paris summit. So far, the Energy Greening Fund has a paltry $10 billion in contributions from the wealthy, including the US, the UK, and the EU. The initial aim is to ensure that Africa enjoys 10 gigawatts of new green power by 2020. The other sticky issue besides financing is transparency, according to metrics that require upfront investment just to achieve reporting compliance. The main UN climate meeting this year will be in November in Marrakesh, Morocco. Representatives from 120 countries attended the second session of the United Nations Environment Assembly in Nairobi, Kenya last week, reports SABC. As promised in the conference title, the conference adopted 25 resolutions for delivering on the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and also on the promises made at the COP21 in Paris in December 2015. According to the UN, 12.6 million people died in 2012 as a result of living or working in an unhealthy environment due to anthropogenic climate change, use of harmful substances, depletion of life-giving water, and generation of mountains of foul waste, reports the South African News Journal Search. As many as 65% died from non-communicable diseases, as many as 7 million from air pollution, as many as 4 million from use of wood stoves for indoor cooking. Other leading environmental causes of death include lack of sanitation and clean drinking water, and poisoning from lead, mercury, or asbestos. We are still investigating the effects of the microplastics which are found in the stomachs of animals in every ecological niche from zooplankton to whales. Quote, most of the environmental health risks are consequences of development, which has led to ecosystem disruption, climate change, inequality, unplanned urbanization, as well as unsustainable consumption and production patterns, close quote. Deaths attributable to the environment were highest in Southeast Asia at 28%, followed by 27% in the Western Pacific. In Europe, it's 15%. Among infectious diseases, an increasing proportion are zoonotic, or passed from animals to humans, usually as a result of agricultural practices. The UN urges four courses of action in order of priority: detoxify our lifestyle, decarbonize our energy and transportation strategies, reduce resource extraction, and conserve nature. A handful of initiatives are worth noting. Germany is establishing a circular economy with significant financial disincentives for waste disposal. Bhutan uses a gross national happiness indicator of the spiritual, physical, environmental, and social health of its citizens to measure prosperity instead of the economically oriented gross domestic product. The country has doubled life expectancy and enrolled almost all children in primary education in the past 20 years, and almost halved maternal mortality rate and poverty in the past 10 years. The Costa Rican government has signed 15,000 contracts with landowners and distributed over $300 million to landowners and farmers to reverse deforestation and reduce poverty. Botswana, too, uses an ecological services model to determine the true value of natural resources, optimize their use, and assess how they can be used to diversify the economy and reduce poverty. Finally, China is distinguishing itself with its reforestation and urban green building programs. The G7 met last week in Isashima, Japan, and heard evidence that reducing hydrofluorocarbons, black carbon, and methane can cut the rate of near-term warming by half, reports the Huffington Post. Clearly, Professor V. Ramanathan from Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California at San Diego was confused when he stated that, quote, by decreasing warming by 50%, about 0.6 degrees Celsius, it gives our engineers and technology experts an additional 25 years to bring the planet to carbon neutrality, close quote. Say what? How does decreasing the rate of warming by 50% say anything about the amount of warming? The professor noted that slowing global warming is essential to avoid catastrophic changes such as sea level rise, extreme weather events, and diverse global health impacts, as if we're not already experiencing these things. The G7 are the US, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the UK. The 32-page report of their proceedings can be found online, and in my not-so-humble opinion, it's absolute rubbish, starting with the second sentence of the preamble, quote, global growth remains moderate and below potential, while risks of weak growth persist, close quote. And it's downhill from there, with the most fleeting of references to the Paris Accord until page 26. On page 28 is this statement, quote, we remain committed to the elimination of inefficient fossil fuel subsidies, close quote. That's right, y'all, we need more efficient subsidies, the oil must flow. With the word remain in there, how else can that sentence be interpreted? Efficient fossil fuels, is that anything like clean coal? And just to triple check, I followed HuffPo's link to the WhiteHouse.gov fact sheet, where that same language appears about elimination of inefficient fossil fuel subsidies, a commitment that apparently dates back to 2009. And the policy direction since 2009 regarding subsidies reinforces that same clandestinely warped intention. Speaking of clandestinely warped intentions, the African Development Bank and the African Risk Capacity Agency formalized their partnership at a meeting in Lusaka, Zambia last Wednesday, reports All Africa. With a presence in just 34 of its 54 member states, financial underwriting from the UK and Germany, and corporate headquarters in Japan, the AFDB is chartered to promote economic development. The ARC agency is not a government agency at all, but rather a private insurance company that, quote, transfers the burden of weather risk away from governments, enabling them to build resilience and better plan, prepare, and respond to extreme weather events, close quote. Say what? This match is being touted as a true public-private partnership, but resources are being extracted and sent offshore, while the public is being left literally in the dark. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo wonders why the international oil companies burn off their waste gas instead of converting it to electricity for local use. I wonder why doing so wasn't a precondition of their doing business there in the first place. Did Obasanjo think they would provide electrical power for the host country out of the goodness of their cold corporate hearts? Foreign interests own Nigeria, not Nigerians. And now, with the advent of disaster insurance and the further monetization of resources, especially agricultural resources, the noose tightens so that even more people's livelihoods are dependent on foreign investment and humanitarian handouts. At the midterm review of the 2011 Istanbul Program of Action for the world's least developed countries last weekend, United Nations Development Program Administrator Helen Clark said that economic diversification is the key to development in the least developed countries. She noted that humanitarian aid is inadequate to achieve development benchmarks. At the same time, it can be difficult for LDCs to mobilize domestic resources for development and to attract sustained private investment because they are seen as a riskier bet. These countries remain very vulnerable to shocks, from extreme weather events and commodity price fluctuations to disease outbreaks such as Ebola. ExxonMobil shareholders voted down a resolution Wednesday that called for the company to disclose the effects of climate change on its operations, reports the Washington Examiner. Exxon's chairman, president, and CEO Rex Tillerson agrees with Bill Gates's claim that, quote, the focus on ramping up deployment of today's technologies diverts attention from the critical need to greatly intensify spending on basic research and large-scale development of new energy technologies, close quote, reports Think Progress. But a 2015 study led by the MIT Energy Initiative finds that crystalline silicon technology is mature enough to expand to terawatt scale as soon as the industry can reduce its reliance on silver for electrical contacts. How likely is that? A terawatt is 1,000 gigawatts or 1,000,000 megawatts. For comparison, the world's largest solar photovoltaic or PV power station is currently the 579-megawatt Solar Star system in California. But the President of the United States is still squeezing with a demand for emissions data from contractors throughout its $400 billion per year supply chain. Last week also saw the 50th annual meeting of the Canadian Meteorological and Oceanographic Society and the Canadian Geophysical Union, reports Essentials Echo. Topics covered include ocean acidification, seismology, and underwater sensing. Significantly, participation in the conference included agencies that were not welcome under the Harper administration. Next week, New York will host the 2016 Health and Climate Colloquium, reports the Huffington Post. Of particular concern is the prediction by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control that 20% of Puerto Ricans will contract Zika this year due to improved breeding conditions for the vector mosquito. And Reuters reports that the virus has already made itself at home in subtropical regions such as southern Florida. The federal government's recently released climate and health assessment finds that, quote, already in the United States, we have observed climate-related increases in our exposure to elevated temperatures, more frequent, severe, or longer-lasting extreme events, degraded air quality, diseases transmitted through food, water, and disease vectors such as ticks and mosquitoes, and stresses to our mental health and well-being. Almost all of these threats are expected to worsen with continued climate change. Some of these health threats will occur over longer time periods or at unprecedented times of the year. Some people will be exposed to threats not previously experienced in their locations, close quote. The LA Times notices the absence of discourse about climate change in the U.S. electoral arena and speaks my mind when they add, quote, we'd like to say that is surprising, but unfortunately it's to be expected, close quote. A March assessment by Media Matters found that only 22 of 1,477 questions asked by corporate media reporters in 20 presidential debates were about global warming, and nearly a third of those were in two Florida debates. Yes, Florida, where some brave mayors took the restriction on talking about climate change in a public venue as an invitation to nonviolent direct action and demanded of the media that the issue be raised. Among voters, a February Gallup poll found climate change low on the priority list, especially for Republicans, among whom it placed dead last in priority. That's a lot of heads in the sand. The Times then lists some of the internal displacement and climate refugee issues we've been spotlighting here on Sequitur and concludes, quote, Unless we stop looking at it as a back burner issue, we're going to pay the consequences much sooner than we think. On the other hand, Inside Science reports that John A. Knox, professor of geography, University of Georgia, seems to believe that too much attention is being paid to climate change by the public based on his analysis of 185,000 tweets during Hurricane Sandy to learn, quote, how the public perceives, misperceives, and reconceives an extreme weather event, unquote. I say seems to believe because the article is so poorly written that it's hard to make sense of it. But it sounds like he wants us to sit on our thumbs and wait for official word from meteorologists or maybe from the notoriously cumbersome Federal Emergency Management Agency, better known as FEMA. I'm serious. I challenge you to look up the reference, read the article, and see if you can glean anything coherent from it. Rather than wait for the U.S. Supreme Court decision on the Clean Power Plan, local governments in Colorado have launched the Colorado Communities for Climate Action, a coalition aimed at the kind of drastic and immediate reduction in greenhouse gas emissions that might have made a difference 40 years ago had they been implemented at a global scale. The Denver Post reports that the locals demand swifter implementation of a national clean power plan, better public transit, denser housing that discourages driving, cleaner sources of electricity, tougher vehicle miles per gallon standards, and bigger paybacks for residents who switch to electric vehicles. Colorado has faced increasingly ruinous wildfires, floods, forest die-offs, heat waves, and water supply challenges as snowfall shifts to rain. And with that shift comes the motivation of that all-important economic threat to the tourist industry. The people of Fort Collins, for example, have rallied 300 businesses in efforts such as swapping light bulbs to use less electricity and cutting consumption of materials that end up in landfills. City employees are issued bus passes. Road crews installed bicycle lanes to improve alternatives to driving. City officials also put up solar panels. Residents can subscribe to receive power from these instead of burning fossil fuels and pay less to the city-owned utility. The Times Union urges New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to reject the Pilgrim Pipeline and Port Oil Heating Facility on the grounds that these projects will contribute to climate disruption, emit harmful pollutants into air and water, and place lives at risk while establishing Albany, New York as a global oil shipping hub. The governor is urged to keep his climate and clean energy promises rather than investing further in obsolete infrastructure. Rising demands for biofuels, particularly in the United States, is having a huge impact on food availability in developing countries, according to Deutsche Welle. By international agreement, the biofuels must flow even if the people are starving. So when drought and flood ruin crops, the price of food goes up. Food market speculation also distorts prices in such a way that it is often more expensive to grow food than to import it, especially in regions suffering from drought and deforestation. According to the Tampa Bay Times, it's not a matter of if but when Tampa Bay's lucky streak will end. The last major hurricane was in 1921, the last direct hit in 1946. While this hurricane season is predicted to be about average with 10 to 16 named storms, 1 to 4 of them severe, it only takes one direct hit north of the city to sweep a crippling storm surge ashore due to the flat topography and the shallow seafloor on the Florida Gulf Coast. The Wyoming Register Herald reports that the Bluestone Dam, quote, is currently undergoing 2 simultaneous projects to address deficiencies, unquote, according to Army Corps of Engineers project manager Aaron Smith. One involves the installation of 500 high-strength anchors that help secure the dam to its foundation. The other is building an auxiliary spillway to protect the floodplain population in case of an extreme weather event. Currently, the dam handles 60,000 cubic feet of water on a busy day. The improvements will double the current 430,000 cubic foot capacity. Some deficiency. I wonder what the price tag is, and if that population will now be eligible to pay even more money to outsource the risk of living on a floodplain to the corporate risk takers, otherwise known as insurance companies. ABC reports one dead and four missing, with 30-plus water rescues and hundreds evacuated from their homes as 42 centimeters of rain fell on Texas between Houston and Austin last week. Some 100 head of cattle were rescued from floodwaters. Another 700 were not. WLKY reports that some stations recorded more than twice the normal rainfall, and that in the same week last year, the region was experiencing moderate drought conditions. An analysis by the Austin American-Statesman finds that a combination of rapid population growth and strong resistance to regulation of building in floodplains, as so-called 100-year floods become increasingly commonplace, have earned Central Texas its designation as Flash Flood Alley. As many as 12 new building projects per year are being permitted in one such floodplain. Tropical Storm Bonnie was not a very strong hurricane, but it came with enough moisture to wreak havoc along its path, reports the Weather Channel. As much as 26 centimeters of rain fell on coastal South Carolina and Georgia on Sunday, after which Bonnie turned north along the Interstate 95 corridor and drenched the North Carolina coast before returning eastward to the ocean around Wilmington, North Carolina. And it came several days before the official start of hurricane season, which is June 1st. Are you wondering what happened to the letter A? Remember Alex back in January? This past weekend set high temperature records in eastern Canada and the northeastern United States, reports the Quebec Suburban. Last Friday, Montreal had 31.7 C, surpassing the 1978 record by 1.3 C. On Sunday, Ottawa reached 33.2 C, breaking the 1978 record by 1.8 C. And it was so hot in Burlington, Vermont on Sunday that organizers called off the Vermont City Marathon for the first time in the race's 28-year history, after runners were already on the course 4 hours into the event. The western U.S. is also having a heat wave with temperatures up to 10 C hotter than normal for the season, reports the Weather Network. There was hail in Colorado and severe storms in half of Arkansas and Missouri surrounding some seriously severe weather, reports AccuWeather. Huffington Post reports that last Tuesday saw more than 30 tornadoes in 5 states from Michigan to Texas. Wednesday, 14 tornadoes in Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. Thursday, 16 tornadoes in 5 states. Flooding in Texas killed 4 people, 3 of these while in their vehicles, and 2 more are still missing, reports NBC. A 10-year-old boy was still missing midweek after falling into the Brazos River while fishing on Saturday. In a similar fashion, an 11-year-old boy went missing in Kansas. A large destructive tornado churned across the landscape near the small town of Solomon, Kansas, for nearly 2 hours, reports the Washington Post. It stripped the bark from tree trunks, destroyed multiple homes, and caused minor injuries. According to Vunderground blogger Jeff Masters, the EF4 tornado was roughly 1/2 mile wide and lasted for 90 minutes. It is very rare for an individual tornado to last more than an hour. The tornado tracked along Interstate 70 and barely missed the tiny town of Talmadge and passed just south of Abilene and the smaller town of Chapman. Masters emphasized that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Storm Prediction Center was spot on with their call for a 2% chance of tornadoes, since this refers to probability, not intensity, and the number of tornadoes in the area affected were actually quite small. The Telegraph reports that southern England and Wales are experiencing temperatures 4°C above the seasonal norm, and cites a 46-page report of a joint project by NHS England and Public Health England that includes recommendations for home renovations such as choosing white paint, installing outdoor shutters, and replacing metal blinds and dark curtains. Along with avoiding caffeine and alcohol and heavy foods, another behavioral mitigation I haven't mentioned in previous reports is a damp cloth on the back of the neck. The report also names threshold temperatures for a population bred to a cloudy, chilly climate. They say people start to die at 24.5 C, although that might depend on pre-existing cardiac and pulmonary dysfunction. Roads begin to melt at 33 C, but at 36 C, even the railroads are in trouble. Chief Medical Officer Professor Dame Sally Davies warns that highs in excess of 38 C that broke 500-year records in the 2003 heat wave will be commonplace by 2040. That 2003 heat wave killed 20,000 Europeans, including 2,000 Brits. Storm Elvira had already passed through, and there was no rain, and the sky wasn't dark when 35 people were injured, mostly children, three of them seriously, including the referee, by a lightning strike at a children's football match in Germany, reports The Seeker. A few days later, four first responder volunteers were reported killed in the flooding in southern Germany, with two more still missing. In separate incidents, both rescuer and victim perished in the flash flooding, and a youth was struck and killed by a train. Volunteerism is on the decline, at the same time as extreme weather emergencies are increasing. 11 were injured in a similar lightning strike at a children's birthday party at a park in Paris. Elsewhere in France, the local reports that a toddler was drowned in her home after falling down the stairs to the flooded basement. Schools that were being used as shelters are resuming class as people return to their damaged homes and attempt to clean up the flood damage in Sri Lanka, even as people in low-lying areas were evacuating on inundated roads with up to 11 centimeters more of rainfall last weekend, reports News First. As of last week, 27 bodies and 21 limbs have been recovered from the Aranayake landslide, and 6 of the 27 have not yet been identified. The Irrawaddy urges the Myanmar government to invest in water management and implores tradition-bound farmers to use locally available rice seed with a shorter growing season and to include more fast-growing, less water-intensive pre-monsoon crops. From June through August of last year, up to half of the agricultural output was ruined by flooding from Cyclone Komen, which killed 120 people and affected 400,000 households. S.L. Mehta, former Deputy Director General for Education at the Indian Council of Agricultural Research, New Delhi, presented a utopian vision to agricultural science graduates of drudgery-free, computer-driven indoor farms where nutrient-dense crops are grown with efficient use of water resources, reports The Hindu. Mr. Mehta identified extreme weather conditions caused by climatic changes as well as new pests, including insects, bacteria, and parasites, as serious future threats in the context of reduced water availability. India's Narendra Modi promises increase in spending on rural agricultural infrastructure, reports Deutsche Welle. India is the fastest growing major economy in the world at 7.6% annually. NDTV says that India needs better weather forecasting and communication systems, roads, and rails in Northeast India, gateway to Southeast Asia, to help farmers. The Conversation notices that heat waves are getting longer, the more remarkable due to protection from aerosol pollution that kills up to 400,000 people per year. In contrast to the trend toward no-till agriculture, The Hindu proposes that exposing soil to direct sun and high temperatures will increase the capacity of the soil to absorb monsoon floods as long as the farmer waits until 6 centimeters of rainfall has occurred before planting. Quote, almost all the pests in pupal stage and in the shape of spores would have been killed due to the hot weather, close quote, explained Adilabad Agricultural Research Station principal scientist and head Sridhar Chauhan. Three people were killed and 12 were injured when a 2-meter flash flood swept through a popular tourist swimming spot on Sunday, reports the Jakarta Post. 2 weeks ago, 19 died and 2 remain missing at a different waterfall resort in Sumatra due to a flash flood followed by a landslide. The most reliable notice to tourists of an impending flash flood is a change in the color of the water. Mount Sinabung, Indonesia's most active volcano, was the most violent ring of fire eruption of last weekend. Several cities in the area were evacuated, and in the village of Gembar, 7 farmers died from inhaling deadly gases. The region has seen more volcanic activity in 1 week last week than has been normal for a year during the entire 20th century. Other volcanic activity was observed in Costa Rica, Mexico, and Italy. ECNS reports that Northeast China's economy is suffering from 18 months of too little rain, scorching heat, and increased ocean salinity due to El Niño. Fisheries are becoming depleted and inadequate drinking water is becoming a problem. Heat and drought have reduced Thailand's sugar crop by about 14%, reports the Wall Street Journal. A recent paper in Current Biology reports a population boom among cephalopods, who adapt easily to increases in ocean temperature and acidity that are killing the coral and our preferred food fish. The United Nations estimates that 2.5 million Malians will face food insecurity, malnutrition, and other consequences of conflict in 2016. Superimposed on the civil uprising that started in 2012 is a conflict between farmers whose yields are shrinking and pastoralists who are descending from the slopes to find fresh forage for their flocks and herds. El Niño effects exacerbated by climate change lend urgency to the needs of both farmers and pastoralists. The civil uprising and the agricultural competition are sources of conflict united only by the escalation of the latter due to the increased presence of weaponry from the former. Writing for the Malay Mail, Ratna Devi Nadarajan cites the Auditor General's report that the victims of the 2014 flood still do not have permanent homes. Quote, "We have been frequented by unpredictable weather patterns, limited warning and preparation, and limited support to recover," unquote. What I deplore as the outsourcing of risk to insurance companies, Nadarajan terms risk transfer and recognizes that, quote, "The costs of climate change will fall on the wider community in some form, either through the premiums of those with insurance, through taxes where the government is insurer of last resort, or by the individual where no insurance is in place," close quote. If community resilience is to be more than just a soundbite or buzzword, then, quote, "it goes without saying that the most vulnerable sectors are basic public utilities infrastructures, food production or agriculture, and health care," close quote. Yet the most adaptation, mitigation, and financial resources are still committed to non-productive private property. Here's an example regarding Canada from the Global News of the kind of Orwellian circumlocution and obfuscation that puts gullible sheeple at the mercy of the insurance industry. Quote, "Over the past six fiscal years, the federal government spent more on recovering from large-scale natural disasters than in the previous 39 fiscal years combined," close quote. This does not mean that there was 6.5 times as much damage from natural disasters or even that recovery spending was 6.5 times as great. It only says that as insurance company profits are soaring with more property owners purchasing increasingly expensive coverage, the taxpayer is paying 6.5 times as much for disaster recovery. What's wrong with that picture? Here's another mixed message, this one from the Edmonton Journal, calling for an approach that, quote, "incentivizes homeowners to mitigate their own risks, invests in resilient infrastructure and mitigation efforts, and makes sure insurance is available and affordable to prepare for severe weather events that are now occurring more frequently," unquote. The Insurance Bureau of Canada has recently completed a floodplain mapping project that finds 19% of Canadian households are at risk for flooding. The Weather Network announced the return of the first of the Fort Murray evacuees on Wednesday. Some 2,000 who expected to return this weekend are prevented from doing so by the presence of toxic ash and debris, as 567 homes and about a dozen apartment complexes have been declared uninhabitable. Around 9,000 have been advised to make other short-term plans. Cooler, wetter weather has arrested further growth of the fire, which was just under 580,000 hectares on Monday afternoon. Environment and Sustainable Development Commissioner Julie Gelfand's spring report finds that Canada's floodplain maps have not been properly updated in 20 years. Building codes don't account for a changing climate, and decision makers need better tools for predicting the frequency, duration, and intensity of storms, reports the Chilliwack Times. In statements last week, the premiers of Ontario and British Columbia have both linked the Fort McMurray wildfire with global warming, while defending the importance of Canada's oil and gas industry, reports the National Observer. Green Party leader Elizabeth May was less generous and called for expedited transition away from fossil fuels. A study of shallow lake response to climate change by Carl Havens et al. Was published in Volume 8, Number 6 of the journal Water last weekend. It is available as a PDF download at the Public Access Multidisciplinary Digital Publishing Institute, where scholarly research results are posted for discussion under Creative Commons Attribution Licensing. The scientists studied cyanobacterial harmful algal bloom dynamics in three shallow lakes in low-lying subtropical areas in cyclone strike zones, Lakes Okeechobee and George in Florida, USA, and Lake Taihu in China. They found that major blooms of toxic Microcystis aeruginosa occurred over large areas of Okeechobee and Taihu due to large amounts of runoff and sediment resuspension, and resultant increases in dissolved nutrients in the water column. In Lake George, periods of high rainfall suppressed blooms, whereas in dry periods there were dense cyanobacteria blooms. The United Nations Environment Program finds extreme weather conditions and rising temperatures will make 70% of the world's agricultural production toxic to animals and humans, reports the Kathmandu Post. Nitrates accumulate in crops like wheat, barley, maize, millet, and soybean, among others, because of acute droughts. Prussic acid, or hydrogen cyanide, gets deposited in crops such as flax, maize, coffee, cherries, and apples, among others, as a result of heavy rainfall after prolonged dryness. Mycotoxins, including aflatoxins, accumulate in crops such as coffee, groundnut, maize, oilseeds, peanut, sorghum, tree nuts, and wheat because of increasing temperatures. A paper published in Nature Climate Change last Monday says that burning the remaining global reserves of fossil fuels would add 5 trillion tons of carbon to the atmosphere and raise the temperature 6.4 to 9.5 degrees Celsius globally and 15 to 20 degrees Celsius in the Arctic by the end of the century, reports the Weather Network. Vice calls this the bleakest picture of our future to date, and points out that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change scenarios are based on emissions from the burning of only 2 trillion tons. Lead author Kasia Tokarska says that precipitation would increase by a factor of 4 in some places and decrease by a factor of 3 in others. Gary Griggs, director of the Institute of Marine Sciences and the Long Marine Laboratory at the University of California at Santa Cruz, posted carbon dioxide emission statistics in the Santa Cruz Sentinel. In 2015, the global population emitted about 11 billion tons of carbon dioxide, twice as much as in 1980, and more than 40% more than we had in the mid-1800s. Of that 11 billion tons, about 44% goes into the atmosphere, 30% is taken up by vegetation, and 26% is absorbed by the ocean. In spite of the upsurge in renewable energy generation and fuel-efficient cars, fossil fuels still meet 83% of planetary energy needs. Current emissions are at 404 parts per million and rising. How? Exponentially, of course. Here's the breakdown by country. China, 28%. The U.S., 16%. The EU, 10%. India, 6%. The Russian Federation, 6%. Japan, 4%, and everyone else combined, 30%. This is the highest atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide our planet has seen in at least the past 850,000 years. It's a weird new atmosphere that is now capable of producing storms over temperate latitudes with previously unimaginable heights of 70,000 feet, asserts the Atheist Nexus. The risky transition between El Niño and La Niña, coupled with the new elongated trough patterns that have tended to form due to polar amplification and sea ice loss in the Arctic, make extreme rainfall events highly likely. Current weather forecasting and disaster response models are having some serious difficulty keeping up with the human-forced atmospheric changes that are now in full swing. Most climatologists appear to be completely unaware of or unwilling to report on these new risks. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's precipitation forecast was for less than 8 centimeters on 25 May, just before last Thursday and Friday's extreme rainfall event, when up to 48 centimeters fell. The Flint, Michigan lead contamination scandal has led to investigations of drinking water infrastructure in cities across the U.S. According to the Weather Channel, quote, the EPA is now detecting new contaminants in the water supply from industrial chemicals, pharmaceuticals, and other sources that can pose risks to public health, unquote. In particular, sewage can enter the water supply through overflows or poorly functioning sewage systems, or through polluted storm water or agricultural runoff. Wells may be more vulnerable to such contamination after flooding, particularly if they are shallow, have been dug or bored, or have been submerged by floodwaters for long periods of time. Built in the decades after the Second World War and valued today at around $876 billion, the U.S. grid delivers electricity from some 3,300 utilities with thousands of power plants to 150 million customers through more than 5 million miles of power lines, reports Power Technology. According to 2013 data from the Department of Energy, outages have risen by 285% since blackout records began in 1984, mostly due to the grid's vulnerability to extreme weather events, which have increased in frequency from 2 to 5 per year in the 1950s to 1980s to 70 to 130 per year from 2008 to 2012. Quote, weather used to account for about 17 to 21% of all root causes. Now, in the last 5 years, it's accounting for 68 to 73% of all major outages, close quote. The cost to move the U.S. to a smarter national grid with better protection against blackout events is estimated at $338 to $476 billion. The societal return for doing so is estimated at $1.2 to $2 trillion. That sounds like a pretty good return on investment to me. Reuters reports that Europe's power grid is well prepared for the summer season, with a focus on Germany and France for productivity and a surge in need in the UK, who can afford to import the deficit, and Poland, who cannot. Poland ran short last summer due to lack of cooling water for its coal-fired power plants. Sequitur echoes the Green Bay Press Gazette's recommendation to cultivate pollinator gardens. The Gazette reports that 75% of the world's major food crops are pollinated by bees, wasps, beetles, moths, butterflies, hummingbirds, flies, and bats. Since the 1950s, these species have been in decline due to habitat loss and fragmentation, diseases, parasites, extreme weather, and agricultural practices, especially pesticide exposure. Here are some recommendations. 1. Plant diverse native species that bloom in different seasons. Plant a wide variety of floral colors in monochromatic groups to capture pollinator attention. 2. Select simple and pollen-rich flowers rather than hybridized flowers that have double flower petals and lack pollen. Leave a few patches of bare ground in an isolated, dry, open, sandy area of your landscape and minimize tilling and foot traffic in that area to provide nesting habitat for solitary and ground-dwelling bees. 3. Construct or purchase hive habitats. Replace or disinfect these structures every 2 years to prevent disease occurrence. Rock walls, wooden stumps, and leaf debris also provide habitat for native bees. 4. Seed a few buckwheat or clover patches to attract bees. 5. Never spray insecticides during the blooming period. Integrate a wide range of cultural and mechanical practices to control garden pests. Use pesticide as a last resort and apply in accordance with label directions. 6. When using insecticides in the lawn, mow off any blooming weeds before or after the treatment. Give preference to granular formulated insecticides and water the lawn immediately after application. 7. Spread the word about pollinators and get involved in citizen science projects such as Bumblebee Watch, the Great Sunflower Project, and Monarch Watch. Thanks for following Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio, archived at panina.org. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston. We'll be right back.
Connects us is one.